Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight to hear Peter Fitzsimons, who I will introduce briefly, although he's very well known. Peter is a journalist, of course, with the Sydney Morning Herald and the Herald Sun, and the Sun Herald. He's the author of over 20 books, including Tobruk, Kokoda, Batavia, and biographies of Douglas Mawson, Nancy Wake, Kim Beazley, Nick Farr-Jones, Les Darcy, Steve Waugh, and John Eales. And he's now Australia's biggest selling non-fiction author and has been this over the previous 10 years. Peter's going to address the Sydney Institute tonight on the occasion of the recent publication of Eureka, The Unfinished Revolution. And Janet Grundy's got some copies of Eureka, The Unfinished Revolution down the back, and I'm sure Peter would be happy to sign them after the event. But before we get to that, and before we come to questions and discussion, Peter Fitzsimons is going to talk to the Sydney Institute on the topic, why the Eureka Rebellion still matters. Peter, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you, Jared, and thank you all for that very tepid welcome. I'm joking. It's a very nice welcome. I'm delighted to address the Sydney Institute. I'm knocked out to be in a room like this. I love that line, and when I'm in a room like this, not that I am often, I always love that line from our former Prime Minister, Paul Keating, when he said, if you're not living in Sydney, you're really just camping out. I don't think there are many more magnificent cities in the world than this one. I suspect after that introduction, quite a few of you would be looking at me thinking, well, he looks like a former footballer, no doubt about that. There is no way on earth he looks like an author. And if you are thinking that, you're not the first to have so thought. About 21 years ago was one of the more humiliating moments of my life. I was invited to the highly prestigious opening of the Rembrandt exhibition at the New South Wales Art Gallery, only invited because my sister-in-law was the curator who'd brought it from Holland. And before attending, she'd given me strict instruction, how to wear the black tie properly, how to hold the champagne glass by the stem, and we don't guzzle and throw it down our throat. We sip, and we converse, and we move on. And I was desperately trying to fit in with the glitterati of the Sydney arts world. Couldn't help but notice the Executive Director General of the New South Wales Art Gallery, Edmund Capon, kept sneaking glances at me. What kind of a Neanderthal is this who has wandered into the New South Wales Art Gallery by mistake? I managed to work into the conversation. Actually, I have just finished my first book. And he immediately brightened up, congratulated me, and encouraged me to read another one. In terms of writing this book, I'll give you a very just 1-2 minute background of it. I mean, I can't say exactly when I was first published in the Sydney Morning Herald, but I think it was the 30th of May 1986. And from that moment on, I had a passion for writing. I loved it. I mean, put the glasses down. For me, that is what I wanted to do. My first breakthrough book, if I can call it that, was writing the biography of Nick Farr-Jones. It was a fabulous way to start, given that I was writing a biography of my best friend who'd captained the Wallabies to the World Cup. Nick was a wonderfully colourful subject, did everything from win the World Cup to throwing a sand shoe at Alan Jones's head in the dressing room. Sadly, he missed. I did several other sports books thereafter. The hardest book I did in the late 90s was I wrote a book about Kim Christian Beazley, a former Labor opposition leader. The hardest book, as I say, I've ever done in my life. I knew so little about my subject when I began. But after my first meeting with Kim in Canberra, I flew back to Sydney in what I thought was triumph, sent an email to my editor-in-chief saying I've just agreed to write Kim Beazley's biography. I might be needing some time off. He sent me back an email saying, well done, I'm sure you'll do yourself and the Herald proud. I think you should know, however, that Beazley is spelt with a Z. And so that book toughened me up, because that line, what does not kill me makes me stronger, that book nearly killed me. I then did quite a series of military books, oddly enough. I didn't I wrote a book on Nancy Wake, which I thought would sell 5,000 or 10,000 copies. It sold 20 times that, a couple of 100,000, and that was the first time I realised there was a hunger for Australian history. And so the next 10 years was filled with Kokoda, Tobruk, Kingsford Smith, Mawson, and the best of a lot of them, the best story I'll ever do on the shipwreck of the Batavia. I'll never work on a better, pure story than that. Eureka came along and it was suggested to me, and I wrote something that the reviewers picked up on, a lot of them poo-poo. I wrote that as an Australian, I feel that I've got Eureka in the marrow of my bones. I knew about Eureka. Many of my books, I start from a position of profound ignorance and use that ignorance to tell the story, thinking, well, if I don't know the details or the building blocks for this story, perhaps the readers won't as well. And so I weave in some understanding of it. But Eureka, dimly in my memory when I was perhaps 5 or 6 years old up at the Mangrove Mountain Community Fair, I dimly remember there was a stockade and there were young boys in red coats and there were those of us who were in a rebel, and I remember being very glad that I was a rebel because I was on the side of the goodies. And then 10 years later I was in history class at Knox in Rex Ward's fourth year class, and I was doing what I always did in history class, which was counting the bricks from the top to the bottom and multiplying them from the right to the left to work out how many bricks there were in the room, because I found that it passed the time. Rex started talking about Eureka and I listened. The first time I really listened, I thought, what a fabulous story this is. Partly because it's a great story in its own right, but for me as a young Australian, the great thing about it was, it wasn't a French Revolution, it wasn't a Russian Revolution, it wasn't an American Civil War. It was a great Australian story. And not that I then went on to do history at Sydney University or whatever, but I had an appreciation for how strong it was as a story. So the genesis of this particular one, doing this particular story, was that I'm on the board of AusFlag, which is basically devoted to Australia getting a flag of our own, unencumbered by a foreign flag on our flag. Call us patriotic, call us unpatriotic or whatever, but that's the basic idea. I always cite the line that I love from Jerry Seinfeld, the great American comedian, who came out to Australia in the year 2000, and he said, "I love your flag, Great Britain at night." And one night we were over there at Crow's Nest and we were sitting around the boardroom table and, you know, we're having dinner and we were going through submissions of various flags that our fellow citizens had put forward. And really, to be fair to them, they were wonderful, a lot of them. But if there was a theme, it was boomerangs, kangaroos, meat pies, Holden cars. You know, there was that sort of symbolism. And I remember having this moment thinking, I just don't think that Australia is going to salute one of these flags ahead of a flag that we've had for the last 100 years. It's unlikely, even though the red ensign and the blue ensign has changed, etc. But that started me thinking down the path of what a pity we don't have, you know, a flag that was homegrown from 200 years ago, a la the Americans with Betsy Ross, and the rocket's red glare, the bombs bursting in air, gave proof through the night that our flag was still there. Which obviously sent me down the path thinking of Eureka, the Eureka flag as a possibility, which I, of course, rejected, because on the one hand, it's too far associated with the BLF and the hard left militant of the union movement, and on the other hand with the nutters on Cronulla Beach ludicrously brandishing the Eureka flag as an absurd symbol of white supremacy. So I rejected it. But then I started looking into the story and started researching it and reading about it and coming to some understanding of it. And initially I had a few discouraging people. A few people discouraged me. One famous Labor cabinet minister, let's just call him Bob Carr, waved a dismissive hand and said, "Eureka, local tax revolt." Just like that, local tax revolt, nothing more than a local tax revolt. And I passionately believe it was a hell of a lot more than a local tax revolt. And without turning this into a detailed history lesson, A, because I'm not qualified on everything around Eureka, but just with the broadest of all broad brushstrokes, I was fascinated by the history of Melbourne to begin with. John Batman coming over from, well, first of all, it was first settled in 1903. It was a disaster. 1803, they were there for about 6 months. They wanted to do a la Sydney Cove to establish a settlement. Three convicts got away. They left them behind, and 32 years later, Batman comes up the Yarra River, begins a settlement, out of the blue comes seemingly a wild man of Borneo who was one of those convicts that had survived the previous 32 years, has had two Aboriginal wives, five children. What were the chances that a man like that, a convict, could survive and speak the language and do that? Some would say the chances were Buckley's and none. And that's, his name was William Buckley. That's where that whole expression came from. But as they settle, so 1835, they settle Port Phillip Bay and the surrounds, and then they start to move out into what was known as Australia Felix, the central lands of Victoria, which for squatters was absolutely fabulous because they could go out, and the broad rule was you could put your homestead, you couldn't put your homestead within 3 miles of another squatter. So very quickly in that late 1830s, the squatters spread out through Victoria. The rule was you could have, I think it came to 6,000 acres, and for the privilege of having that 6,000 acres, you'd pay the government, the Victorian government, you'd pay them, well, initially it was the New South Wales government, it became the Victorian government later, but you'd pay them £10 a year. So for 6,000 acres, you'd get £10 a year. Meantime, all through Europe, you've got this broad rise of the people starting to demand the basic tenets of liberal democracy that we know today. In Great Britain, they were called the Chartists, and they had six basic demands. It was a curious coalition in Great Britain between liberal democratic politicians and the working class. And the six basic demands of the Chartists were: they wanted males over 21 to be able to have the vote, they wanted the secret ballot, no property qualifications for those who voted or those who stood in Parliament, they wanted paid parliamentarians, they wanted constituencies of equal size, and they wanted an annual Parliament to be elected annually. So they were the six basic demands of the Chartists, and all over Europe there was this same rise of the people, and all over Europe, we remember our history lessons, 1848, it was all beaten down, mostly by men with bayonets. And my favourite part of it was 23rd of April 1848, 15,000 Chartists marched on Parliament House in London, and they sent out the redcoats to stop them, and the colonel of the redcoats said to the leader of the Chartists, if you cross the bridge, cross the Thames towards Parliament House, we will shoot you and then we'll disembowel you. Do you still want to come? And they said, no. And that was all over Europe. That was broadly that the people rose and they were suppressed. And by pure happenstance, at this time that you've got this broad democratic movement rising up, splintered by force, right then, when the activists were looking, well, what now? In 1849, they discovered gold in California. And so lots of the activists, a lot of them came from Europe. But here in Sydney, we were the closest. None of them quite knew where California was. But you get in the ship, straight out the heads, head over to California. One of them was a man by the name of Edward Hargraves. And he was not a great miner, but he was a great schemer. And while he was over there, we all remember this from our primary school studies, I think a lot of us remember that he looked at the countryside and thought, this looks very familiar, this gold-bearing country. Where have I seen it before? Somewhere up near Bathurst. So early 1851, he comes back through the heads, he borrows £10, he goes up Parramatta Road, up and over the Blue Mountains, gets to this tiny, tiny little place on Summerhill Creek, and he's with a young man who's 23 years old, who's a local, and they get to the spot that looks exactly the way he's remembered it. And he's a very big man, he's 20 stone, and even though he wants to discover gold, what he most wants is lunch. So they have lunch, they have their lunch and they stand up, and then he gets the pan and he starts panning, and there in the bottom of the pan is four tiny little specks of gold. And he builds himself up, puffs himself up, and says to the young man, I shall be a lord, you shall be a baronet, and my old horse will be stuffed and sent to the British Museum. Everything is going to change from here. And he was right. Sydney went mad. Half of Sydney starts heading out to Sydney to get to this place called Ophir, O-P-H-I-R. And more to the point, half of Melbourne starts to come up from Melbourne to get to this place where they can get the gold. So much so that in Melbourne they decide, if we don't discover gold of our own here in Victoria, we will be abandoned. The city will have to be abandoned. We'll just go bust. And so they put a £200 reward. Who can find gold in Victoria? Within 2 days, there was the declaration, we found gold. And so there's a conversion on the road to Damascus, if you will. So many of the Victorians heading for Bathurst, they found better gold in Victoria. So they head back. And by August, they find this place called Ballarat, and it's an Aboriginal word, Ballarat, great place to lean on your elbow, this beautiful valley. And they start digging for gold, but this is not the gold like they find gold in California. This is gold like they've never found anywhere. In California, they were measuring gold in ounces. In Ballarat, they measured it in pounds. And it just changed the entire social order so that a poor man could go down a hole and come up a rich man. And they were finding nuggets worth 5,000 pounds. Unimaginable when the constables were being paid 5 shillings a week. And the obvious thing happened. When you had that level of gold, that level of wealth available, and the thing about it was, early on, it wasn't deep down, it was just sitting there, it was begging to be picked up. And so when you had that system, what the obvious thing happened, that butcher, baker, candlestick maker, rich man, poor man, beggar man, thief, just headed for the hills. And it's happened in Sydney, and it happened in Melbourne, and you had magistrates, you had politicians, you had most particularly the labourers of the squatters saying, that's enough, I'm off to the diggings. And so what you then had was the squatters who ran the show, who were wealthy and strong and guaranteed riches out of the land that they had, they suddenly, overnight, they're losing their labourers. So they say to the government, you have to impose order on this. They're digging on Crown land. And so the government came up with a system, which was, if you want to dig on Crown land for gold, you can dig on 8 feet by 8 feet, 64 square feet, and for the privilege of this, you will pay 30 shillings a month. Dot 3, carry 1, subtract 2, 18 pounds a year. The diggers say, what? The squatters are paying for 6,000 acres, they're paying 10 pounds a year, can't miss, growing wealthy off the fat of the land. We are hit or miss, maybe we'll find gold, but maybe we won't, and we're paying 18 pounds a year for 64 square feet. How does that work? And so there's the beginnings of this agitation. It starts again in Australia, and a lot of it is powered by so many of the activists who'd previously been very involved in political action all over Europe. And the one that fascinates me most is the obvious one, Peter Lawler, who was the son, the 11th child of a famous political family in Ireland who were very active over there trying to throw off the yoke of British rule. The oldest of them was Fintan Lawler, F-I-N-T-A-N. And I loved the line that he wrote in the Irish Felon, a newspaper in 1848, where he was so impassioned that he said, "Who will strike the first blow for Ireland? Whose wreath will be green forever?" And for his trouble, the Brits threw him in jail, and he died shortly thereafter after being left out. So when Peter Lawler leaves Ireland and comes to Australia, that's the background, that he's got politics in his blood, but he's also seen what happens to those who get involved. And he comes in on the 19th of October, 1852, through the Bay of Port Phillip on the good ship, the Scindian. And the first thing they see is 50 abandoned ships. They see a forest of masts in Hobson's Bay. And why are they abandoned? Because all the sailors thereon jump ship and head for the goldfields, and they can't get them to come back. And so the captain of the Scindian sees this, and he says to Lieutenant Smithers, his second in command, "Smithers, I'm going to be in my cabin. Make sure that nobody leaves." With none of the sailors scupper. Within half an hour, 4 of the sailors, they're down there tarring the sides of the ship, and they scupper. They row away. And the captain roars up on the deck and says, "Where's Smithers?" And Smithers is found in his own chambers, entertaining a female passenger in the traditional manner. And he's dragged up before the captain, and he says, "The cost of that boat will come out of your wages until it's paid back." And the guy, Smithers, looks his captain right in the eye and says, "Well, you can take a dozen times the cost of that boat out of my wages if you'll take an IOU. I don't particularly care." And hence my favourite line in the book. The contemporary account said that in coming from Liverpool, in coming from Great Britain, 7 months on the seas, never once had the second in command ever spoken to the captain in this manner. And yet now he's looking him right in the eye and telling him to get nicked, basically. And he said this wonderful line. He says, "This Australia indeed seems to be a country where Jack is as good as his master. And for me, there is nothing that better defines the national ethos as that Jack is as good as his master." Now, Lawler was simply one of many, and they were coming from everywhere, all over the world, and it was the beginnings of multicultural Australia, what was happening in those goldfields. And so many of the things that I'm proud of Australia in the 21st century, you see the beginnings there. You see multiculturalism. You see people from all over. And by 1852, 1853, most of the easy gold is gone. And so the only way to get the real gold, the big gold, is to get down to the ancient creek beds. Now, if the way it works is, if I can get down to 10 feet on my own, to get to 20 feet, Gerard and I would have to work together. To get to 160 feet, we'll have to be a dozen of us. What are we going to be? We're going to be mates. And that's where it came from. That guy is my mate. We're all digging together. And the way it works is we dig, we find the gold, we put it into a pot, we divide it absolutely equally every Saturday night. How much gold have we got? But it's not just us mates, us 12 mates trying to get to 160 feet. The problem is the water table. If we don't keep getting the slops out, getting the water out, and you guys have got your hole next to us, if we let ours get up, it risks collapsing into yours. So there's this across the gold fields. There's 25,000 people there by 1854. And there's this connection between everybody, not just the diggers, so that's where the name the diggers came from, not just those, but also the shopkeepers. Many of the shopkeepers take a partnership with the diggers. We'll provide you the stuff, and if you find gold, we'll have a share of it. And so it goes that they pay the money that they can. Some of them go bust, and those that go bust are treated very, very badly because the redcoats, the British troops and the Victorian police, tie them to logs, leave them there overnight, fine them if they can't pay their fine. So there are all these digger hunts, and the licence hunts is to go out. Have you got your licence, digger? And if you haven't got your licence, then you're in trouble. And so as 1854 goes on, the gold gets more scarce. You've got to go deeper. There are more and more diggers that don't have their licence. And so on the 11th of November, a date that will become famous in Australian history, 11th of November was not just when Gough was sacked in 1975, also when Ned Kelly was hanged in 1880, but it was also where the Ballarat, and of course November 11th, First World War, also where the Ballarat Reform League was formed. Because what was happening all over Ballarat through that latter part of 1854, the diggers were getting more agitated, they were getting more active, they were making more demands. And on the 11th of November, as I say, they formed the Ballarat Reform League. What did the Ballarat Reform League have? Their first demand was no taxation without representation. They wanted democracy. They wanted the abolition of the mining licence. They wanted the fairer system. But the other six demands that they made were males over 21 to have the vote, secret ballot in these votes, no property qualifications for those who stood for Parliament or those who voted for Parliament, paid parliamentarians, equal constituencies, annual election of Parliament, exactly what the Chartists had wanted in Great Britain. And the thing, as I mentioned, in Great Britain on the 23rd of April 1848, when the bayonets came out for them and they said, you know, you cross the Thames, do you want to cross? No, they disappeared. The difference here was when the confrontation came, they said, you'll actually find us behind the stockade, come and get us. And so it builds up to late November. They have monster meeting after monster meeting. There's progressively greater feeling. They're getting more and more organised. By the latter part of November, they decide they want a flag of their own. The diggers decide they want a flag of their own. And there's great conjecture and contention about who actually sewed the Eureka flag, who actually designed it. One of the ways I write my books is to work out the best I possibly can what actually happened. Footnote, author's note at the back, there are other theories on this. The one that I love most, and I think is actually the designer of the Eureka flag, he was a Canadian, a 25-year-old Canadian by the name of Charles Ross. And I say this advisedly, for those of you who've got the book, if you look up the photo of Charles Ross, got to be the best man, the best looking man who ever lived. I am an avowedly heterosexual man. I support gay marriage, I support gay rights, but I'd turn for that man. He designed the flag, and they, on the 29th of November, on the 11 o'clock on the 29th of November, atop Bakery Hill, they haul up the Eureka flag, and the diggers come from everywhere. And in many ways, it's a forerunner of what happened with the Vietnam War conscripts, because they are jack of it. They are sick to death of it. They've had a gutful, and they take out, a lot of them take out their licences, and put it in the bonfire and say to the redcoats, you want us, come and get us, okay? There you go, we've burnt our licences. This is not fair. No taxation without representation. You've been taking money out of us, we've got no political rights, we want our political rights. At this point, a sane governance would be to pull back. They didn't have sane governance. What they had was the local commissioner, Robert Reed, sent the redcoats in the following morning, and men on horseback, bayonets drawn, they arrested 8 diggers. And there was shooting between them, and there were rocks thrown, and the diggers are enraged. And so it turns out that on the afternoon of the 30th of November, 10,000 diggers are gathered, and there is Peter Lawler, who to this point's only been tangentially involved. And he's wanting to get involved, but he's waiting for somebody to stand up on the stump to address them. Nobody will, and finally he's had enough. And he climbs up the stump, and he puts his fist in the air, and he says, "Liberty!" First words. And then he says, "This is what we're going to do. This is how we're going to do it." And if you see on the front of the painting, it's that beautiful scene of Lawler atop the stump, the diggers around him, the Eureka flag waving in the breeze. And he says, "Everybody kneel down," and they all kneel down in a circle around him, and he says, "Raise your right hand towards the Southern Cross," and they all do that, and they are from all over the world, and he says, "Repeat after me. We swear by the Southern Cross to stand truly by each other and fight to defend our rights and our liberties," and they all repeat it. From that moment, they are brothers and sisters together. Not so many sisters at this point in that gathering, but the sisters will come. And he says, "Right, what we're going to do now is we're going to form up, not battalions, not divisions, they call them divisions, but what we would know as companies, and they're not formed up by nationalities, they are not formed up by size, they're formed up by weaponry. So I want the revolvers over here, the bayonets over there, the pikemen, I want you over there, elect a captain," so they elect all their captains. "Right, we're going to march to the Eureka." They march to the Eureka. They enclose four acres behind a very rough higgledy-piggledy fence, which provides yet some rough kind of defence. And then they start doing their drills. "Present, arms, left, right, left, right." And they're starting to do this military formation. And the redcoats are watching what's happening, and they've got their informers and they've got their telescopes, and they're alarmed. And there's this great feeling of an impending battle. So much so that on the night of the 30th of November, Lawler has sent out emissaries to nearby goldfields to say, "We need men, we need guns, we need ammunition, and we need you now." And the most foremost of them was a Scot by the name of Tom Kennedy, and he gave this brilliant address to 2,000 diggers at Creswick, and he gives this mesmerising speech. And the climax of the speech is, "We don't want you to march tomorrow. The redcoats are coming. We don't want you tomorrow. We don't want you the next day. We need you tonight." And he says, "Speeches and resolutions are humbug. Nothing convinces like a lick in the lung." And he is so impassioned that they march that night. And as they march out of Creswick, which is 18 miles from Ballarat, as they march out, a storm for the ages comes down, and they're marching behind a German band, all these men from all over the world, and as they march, they are singing La Marseillaise. Marchons, marchons. And for me, when I came across that, I just loved it. The vision of a multicultural army marching for democracy, singing La Marseillaise, which was not simply the French anthem, but the great revolutionary anthem of the time. We now get to the 1st of December, and it's again building. And Lawler is there, and in the afternoon, and they're doing their drills back and forth, and Lawler is asked by Nicholson, a man by the name of Nicholson, "What is it that you want?" And Lawler replies, "Independence. We want independence." And with that in mind, that afternoon on the 1st of December, a declaration of independence is penned by the man that Lawler had named as his Secretary of War. His name was Alfred Black. And I love, and we all love, the American Declaration of Independence, which is beautiful phraseology in even more wonderful copperplate on stunning parchment, embodying the great democratic ideals of the day. And it's a wonder to behold 230 or 40 years later. Ours was not like that. Ours was something of a drunken ramble, quite incoherent, and it went on for some time, but it was a declaration of independence, and when Alfred Black stood on a stump on the Friday afternoon and read it out, the diggers cheered. This is what we want independence. On the Saturday, in the classic Australian fashion, things calmed down a little bit. There was a bit of drinking, a little bit of relaxing, a little bit of "I'm missing my missus," And so from out of the stockade, they had 1,000 strong at midday on the Saturday. But come the Saturday night, things start to relax for several reasons. One is there's no chance whatsoever the Redcoats will attack on a Sunday. That's the Sabbath. Nothing happens on the Sabbath. In fact, Commissioner Reid, that was the exact plan. We're going to strike these diggers. And he wrote, to Governor Hotham that night, on that Saturday afternoon. And his words were, make no mistake, if we lose Ballarat, we will lose the colony. Okay, we've got to crush them and we've got to crush them hard. And Hotham had already sent up serious artillery with 800 men were on their way to Ballarat at that time. And at 2 o'clock in the morning, 2:30 in the morning, about 250 redcoats were roused in the government camp. We march and we march now. You've got to be silent. And over the next 2 hours, they form up. They all get nobblers of rum. And they form up around the stockade. Inside the stockade, there's only about 120, 130 at that time, including Peter Lawler. And the redcoats start, and a shot rings out, a shot of warning. One of the diggers outside has seen the redcoats are there, and the Captain Robert Burnett, there are a lot of Americans there, that's another whole story, but Captain Robert Burnett looks over the stockade and he sees the redcoats coming up the hill, and he lines up his rifle and he fires the first shot in anger. Private James Roney falls down dead. And from that moment on, it is on. The redcoats in military formation charge the stockade. The diggers inside fire back at them. Lawler's first commands were California Rangers to the front. And these California Rangers were 20 men that had experience. They were veterans in the Mexican-American War. And they fought well, and they were able to hold them off for about 20 minutes. Lawler got shot in the left shoulder very early on in the battle. He was secreted by his men under a pile of logs. And after 20 minutes, most of the battle was over, but then came the revenge attacks. And the Redcoats did not behave well. They set fire to a lot of the tents around. They did a lot of atrocities, a lot of killings that were not necessary. At the end of the day, there were roughly 25 diggers dead, and four or five of the soldiers were dead. They were marched away. There were 119 of the diggers were in the government camp under lock and key, and then they started the legal process. And at the end of the legal process, they decided to charge 13 of them with high treason. Meantime in Melbourne, have you heard? Civil war. They're coming for us. There are 25,000 diggers on the march for Melbourne. They're going to pillage us. We've got to defend ourselves. And that was the fear in Melbourne in the first day or two, that Melbourne was going to be attacked by 25,000 diggers. And then after it became apparent that they weren't on the march, the next thing that came was outrage. The government did what? They killed how many? And why? Because they didn't have their mining licence, they didn't pay their fees. This is an outrage. And it was a great example of the mobilisation of public opinion, that the government went from being totally in control to this huge outrage of the people against what had happened. And the only way that Governor Hotham could justify what he had done was to actually prove that these 13 men had been guilty of treason. And high treason against Queen Victoria. And the trial itself deserves a book of its own, but it was a triumph of Australian justice. These 13 men were put on trial, and the actual defence, the first man put on trial was a black American slave, likely escaped from Louisiana, by the name of John Joseph. And he was a fiercely intelligent man, and he got Irish lawyers to defend him pro bono, and they said to him, we know you're intelligent, we know you're very smart, but for the purposes of this exercise, for our defence of you, we want you to look stupid. We want you to look seriously dumb. Got it? Blink a lot. And the basic defence, and I hesitate to use this word, whether you use the N word, the nigger word, you can only use it, I think, in the historical context, but the defence, and this is written in the Acts, the basic defence was treason, high treason, this riotous nigger from down south, and that was the actual phrase he used in the Age, this riotous nigger from down south, would not know who Queen Victoria is, let alone have acted in a manner, agitated in a manner to bring her down. Everybody looks to John Joseph, blinks, and doesn't defend himself. His whole thing, their whole thing was for him to look stupid. And when, after 2 days of this trial, and he was acquitted. How do you find not guilty? he was raised on the shoulders of the 5,000 people outside, charged up and down Collins Street. And over the next 3 months, he was lauded. The next 3 months, all thought 13 of them were acquitted. So the government was totally discredited. They couldn't have the justification of why they'd done what they'd done because these men were innocent. Peter Lawler, meantime, who'd escaped, who was never put on trial, he had been hunted in the first few months. Reward £200 for this man, Peter Lawler, bring him in. And as I describe him in my book, you know, there he was, no arm, and he's being chased and getting away from the Redcoats, Australia's first one-armed bandit, uphill, down dale, trying to get away from them. But the measure of how the Eureka Stockade totally transformed Australia is that this same man who on the afternoon of 30th November said, raise your right hand, swear fealty to this flag and to each other. This same man on 27th of November the following year, less than a year later, was again raising his right hand. This time he was being sworn in to the Legislative Council of Victoria. And my final line of the book is, he had not changed Australia. His adopted, well, Australia was not yet Australia, but his adopted homeland had changed. And that was the thing, that Eureka transformed everything, that everything that they demanded in this democratic reform was granted over the next, basically over the next 2 years. They had, those that were over 21 were granted the right to vote. They got the secret ballot. There were no property qualifications. They had equal constituencies. The whole thing was granted, and it was Eureka that was the catalyst for it. We were the first country in the world that had the secret ballot. We were among the first to have no property qualifications. We were just behind New Zealand in granting the franchise to women. And it was a, you know, it was something that Australia can be very proud of overall. I've talked to Gerard about this extensively. He wrote a piece in 2004 in the Sydney Morning Herald, which I quote in my book. And his point was that, among many points, was that this is, it's very odd that the Libs, the coalition, have not claimed this story as for themselves as well, because in many ways these guys were not just diggers, not just workers, they were entrepreneurs being crushed by an iniquitous, dare I say, mining tax. I mean, it's right up, it is right up the Libs alley. And I personally think from perspective of 2012 when I wrote it, but now, that there's a whole lot in it for us Australians to be proud of, or we Australians, one of those two. Subs, please check. It's a fantastic exercise in democracy. It led the world in democratic reform. It was superbly multicultural. The great chronicler of what happened, Raffaello Carboni, who was one of the diggers who was from Italy, said we were of all, talked about the time when the flag was raised and they swore fealty. He said, we are of all nations and colours. For the diggers had come together, irrespective of nationality, religion or colour, to salute the Southern Cross as a refuge of all the oppressed from all the countries on earth. Peter Lawler gave his account when he was on the stump. I looked around me. I saw brave and honest men who'd come thousands of miles to labour for independence. I knew that hundreds were in great poverty who would possess wealth and happiness if allowed to cultivate the wilderness that surrounded us. And a lot of people have commented on this. And I love, there was a book that the current parliamentarian Andrew Lee wrote a book in 2004 as well, which was the 150-year anniversary. Sesquicentenary, I think you say, by McGregor Duncan, Andrew Lee, David Madden and Peter Tynan, wrote a book called Imagining Australian Ideas for Our Future. And the piece in the Herald was, time to reclaim this legend as our driving force. And I love this line. They wrote, Australia should re-elevate Eureka to its previous position as a central legend of Australian nationalism, standing for those distinctly Australian values. Egalitarianism, mateship, fairness, together with democracy, freedom, republicanism and multiculturalism. Obviously, Australian nationalism can never be reduced to just one legend, but Eureka offers great potential to a nation floundering for a national story. And I could go on and on, I usually do, but on this occasion I won't. I just think Eureka is a fabulous story, and I'm not going to hijack this occasion and beg you to read my book. I honestly don't care. All I care is that you buy my book. Thank you.
Peter, we're going to have questions and discussion. But I should say, first of all, many thanks to King and Wood Mellicent for the use of this terrific facility this evening. As Peter was saying, it's a It's a great location, but I know you've got readers outside of Sydney, so I won't repeat the poor Keating comment. And so we come to question and discussion. We'll finish no later than 7 o'clock, so we've got 20 minutes. Chandler Grundy's got some copies of Eureka, the Unfinished Revolution, up the back, and so we'll try and get through our questions and comments briefly. Just to commence with where you concluded, I mean, as you know, the Eureka mythology begins to fade fairly soon, although people from time to time have revived it. But why do you think those who took part in it, people like Peter Lawler and others, didn't progress this themselves? Why do you think they let it fade by the turn of the 20th century?
Jared refers in part to Peter Lawler, who in some ways became the first Australian example of the working class can kiss my ass, I've got the foreman's job at last. Because Lawler remained in Parliament, in the Victorian Legislative Council and Assembly, for the next 30 years. He became the Speaker of the House, and he became in many ways a bastion, you know, the leader, bastion of conservatism, and to the point that I think it was in 1871 where outside his parliamentary duties he also had a share in a mine, and when the workers went on strike, by that time in the early 1870s it was really an industrial operation. It wasn't just 5 guys or 12 guys digging, but it was an industrial operation. The miners went on strike. Lawler was right behind bringing in Chinese workers to break the strike. And that spoils the story somewhat, that Lawler, you know, it would be much better if Lawler had gone on to be the great defender of everything he'd once fought for. Although Lawler does make the case that not quite unlike Malcolm Fraser. I mean, Malcolm Fraser's always being accused of having moved to the left, and he says, I didn't move to the left, the party moved to the right and just left me here. Whereas Lawler in 56, 1856, argued against some of the things he did previously argued for, and I couldn't make head nor tail of how he could justify it. But as I say, I'm starting to ramble here. Why I wish he'd stayed true. Go on.
Right.
Yes.
Ellis. Yes.
You've mentioned briefly your method for research, mm-hmm. but I was wondering if you could talk a little about, you're clearly an excellent storyteller, about how you go from the historical material and the first-hand accounts and your research to the book.
I'm doing it at the moment with Ned Kelly. Okay, so my publisher doesn't want me to do this, but I want to do this. I want to call it Ned Kelly Rides Again. Because what I want to do, and Jared mentioned I've done 26 books now, whatever it is. I had an epiphany I didn't even know how to spell epiphany in 1998, and now I are one. I had an epiphany in about 2000, 2001, when I came under the influence of an American writer by the name of Gary Smith, who came out to Australia for the Olympics. And I used to read his stuff and just realise his stuff, his feature writing in sport, was so much stronger than my stuff. And why was it? And he'd explain it to me. And the reason is because he would use the devices of fiction and apply them to non-fiction. And so he wouldn't have, you know, the best example, and I'll do this in 2 minutes because I've done it many times, the best example, he wrote a feature article about a guy, David Duval, who's a golfer. And if those of you who remember David Duval, a famously taciturn American golfer, if you ever see him interviewed, it looks like just a second before the cameras were upon him, he won the World Lemon Sucking Competition, just like that. And he wrote this piece, and the opening line of his piece about David Duval is, he says, the 7-year-old boy lies on the bed. His father holds down his wrestling his shoulders down. His mother sits on his leg, and the doctor is driving the needle into his bones as he screams. And it's just like that. It's so strong. You're sitting on the bed with a 7-year-old boy as a needle's driven into his bones. He had a bone marrow disease. And so that's how he sets the scene. The standard brand journalistic way of doing that, of an article on David Duval will be, David Duval came into the restaurant. Everybody looked around. I think that's David Duval. Isn't that David Duval? Yes. He came down, sat opposite me, and he said, I'll never forget when I was 7 years old when I had a bone marrow disease. So we've seen that format a million times. So it's classic non-fiction. And so as my books have gone on, I want more and more to... I used to want to be known as a storyteller. I wanted the readers, when they're reading my stuff, to say, geez, he's a good storyteller. I no longer want that. What I want is I want the reader to feel like they're in the middle of the story. So you get the fine detail. So if I say to you that when Mawson went to Antarctica, and he was getting close to the South Magnetic Pole. It was very, very cold. It was 40 degrees below zero. That doesn't mean anything. What is 40 degrees? But if you say that when he pressed his nose, the nose hairs broke and crackled. So every time, that's how cold it was. That the sailors, when they arrived in Antarctica, loved going there. They didn't have to shave. Why? Because when they woke up, it was so cold they could just brush off their beard and they'd be ready for breakfast. So those are the fine details. So in terms of, and I've got structural problems at the moment with doing Ned Kelly, because in the, well, when you have two separate accounts of what happened, the particular one being I always get the Fitzpatricks and the Fitzgeralds mixed up, but there was a constable that accused, said Ned Kelly and his mother tried to murder me, and Ned Kelly fired a gun at me from a yard and a half and missed. Yeah, right. As if, and it went through his wrist. And so there's two totally, totally different accounts of what happened that turned Ned Kelly to being a criminal. And nobody knows which one is correct. So the structural problem I've got is, how do I keep the reader in the moment to be historically accurate and work out? And the answer I've got is, I've just worked this out the other day, that after he comes back, we'll give his account of what happened to the sergeant who took it all down, and then when we get to the trial, we'll get the other account. So I don't want the reader to feel an historian droning on and on and on. I want them to be in the middle of the story. And there was a brilliant American biographer, and I can't remember his name, Julia Baird, sent me a piece that written about him in 1999, where he made the point, the king dies and the queen dies is not a story. The king dies and the queen dies from grief, that's the story. So one of the things that I do is, you know, I love anecdotes, I love stories, I love making the story live and breathe. I use researchers extensively and I'm constantly making notations to myself. L&B, L&B, L&B means live and breathe, live and breathe, live and breathe. Find the detail to put the reader in the moment. And I'm also saying SNT, 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 which is show not tell, show not tell, show not tell. And this methodology of trying to get the reader into the story occasionally drives, or sometimes even often, drives reviewers berko. I don't care. It's a literary drug, and once you write like that and get the reader into the moment while staying, what's the word I'm looking for? Not making stuff up, but choosing, if there are two or three, you know, details, you note, this is what I think happened, and then I put an author's note at the back to say, this, there is an alternative, for example, on the thing of the flag. So you cover all your bases. But the idea is to make history live and breathe. And I don't pretend, look, I didn't used to be, I used to always say I'm not a historian, I'm a historian. But of the books that I'm proud of that I've done in history, as I say, Batavia, I'll never do a better story than that. Eureka, I'm damn proud of that because, you know, every sentence in that was hit with a hammer to make sure it didn't sound hollow. And I just love the story as an Australian. Yeah. Any more questions?
Well, hang on, where are we now? There's a question here. Just hang on a second. On a more modern theme, what do you think's happened to the Australian Republican movement?
On a more modern theme, what do you think's happened to the Australian Republican movement?
I think, look, the general mood of Australia at the moment is wait till the Queen dies. And I personally think it completely ludicrous that our sovereignty should depend on the health of an elderly English woman. And I do. It's just, it is ludicrous that we should be waiting for the Queen to get crook before we talk about the Republic again. But I can't tell you how much horror the thought of King Charles fills me with. I find it absurd that, you know, here we have 130 Australians in this room, that my children and your children should be standing in a queue behind the idea that in the 21st century we pick our head of state from the latest one from the loins of an English aristocratic family. I mean, please, how can anybody argue for that? I do forgive people, and this is not ageist, but when people are over 75, when they send me emails, I sort of say, all right, well, you know, you've lived with it all your life. But it does, I get this, and I know I'm probably offending a lot of people here, so be it. Please, we are the 21st century. Can we Australians not run our own show? And the way that I think it should be done, for what it's worth, seeing as nobody asked, I'll tell you. 1975, up to 1975, you had recourse to the Privy Council. You know, so if you're not happy with what happened on the High Court, you could go to the Privy Council. Gough shut it down, saying that we can run our own show, our High Court judges, you know, will sort it out themselves. What happened? We got on with it. The system in 2013, when we have the election at the end of this year, 14th of September, I'm not sure how it works with the Governor-General, if it's a three or four-year term, but next time the Governor-General comes on call, the Prime Minister will, the way it works is, chooses a Governor-General, writes to Buckingham Palace and says, this is the person I've chosen, and Buckingham Palace says, yes, here is my system. We don't change anything except this. We keep the name of the Governor-General, we keep the electoral process, we don't do anything other than the Prime Minister will choose the Governor-General, and instead of asking the Queen or the Buckingham Palace, we'll simply ask the incoming Parliament, what do you say? Parliament says, yep, you beauty, representatives of the people, and we all get on with our lives. How simple could that be, that we Australians can run our own affairs simply on the Privy Council model? We don't need a president, we don't need to change the system, we don't need to change the constitution, we need to change just one thing, that it's the Parliament, the representatives of you and I, that sign off on the decision, not the Queen. Let me hear you say, hey.
Hey.
Yeah. I'll declare that passed.
Yes, you've mentioned that the Eureka wasn't as fine as the other countries in their revolutions in fighting for civil rights and independence and so forth. My question is that, do you think, civil rights is more about fighting for the rights of the entrepreneur against taxation, against regulations?
I believe in the words of Andrew Lee, there is something in Eureka for everybody. But it's crazy that the Libs of the Coalition don't say, they're our boys, those entrepreneurs, they're our boys being crushed by those taxes. I mean, they haven't yet claimed that ground. But I, as I say, I think there is something for everybody in the story.
Peter, you live and breathe the Australian kind of character.
Mm-hmm.
You dramatise our history so you make it interesting. My granddaughter the other day threw a bit of history, said Australia was boring.
Yeah.
History was boring. That's what the kids need. Your dramatisation is a bit like making a movie of the past. So if one of your books was made to a movie, which would be the best?
Several of my books are being made into movies. And Batavia, I've learned over the years that the difference between selling the rights to a movie and actually having a movie is enormous. And I sold the rights to Nancy Wake in 2001. I'm told it's being made shortly. I won't believe it's being made until I see a long red carpet with me at one end and Richard Wilkins with a microphone at the other. Nancy Wake, then I'll believe it. But more to the point, Batavia, I've sold the rights to Screen Time that did Underbelly. They're doing an 1-hour series coming out. Well, being start to shoot it in August, and it'll be on Channel 10 screens, so long as Channel 10 still exists, next year, which I'm excited about. I've also sold the rights to Eureka for a 4-by-1-part series, also to Screen Time, and I'm just in the process of selling the rights to Les Darcy, and they're all wonderful stories. If you're running out of gas on questions, can I give you 1 minute of the story of Batavia or not?
Yes,
yeah. Yeah, okay. Let me just tell you Batavia very quickly. 29th of October, 1628, the Titanic of its day, biggest ship ever built from Holland with more treasure than it's ever had, leaves Amsterdam Harbour, and it's heading for the Dutch East Indies, which we more or less now know as Indonesia. On board, you've got this total psychopath by the name of Geronimus Cornelis. You've got Lucretia, the most beautiful woman in Holland. You've got Admiral Pelsart, who's the admiral of the fleet, and you've got this old salt Captain Jacobs, and they're on this ship, and they go across to Brazil, come down to the tip of what we now know as South Africa, and Geronimus makes a play for Lucretia. Jacobs makes a play for Lucretia. She's going to join her husband. They head across, Jacobs, the old salt captain, gets what is known in the Australian vernacular as pissed as a newt. And he disgraces himself, and Pelsart, in front of all the others, says to Jacobs before they leave where Cape Town now lies, "You're a disgrace! You're a disgrace to the industry, you're a disgrace as a captain, you're a disgrace to this ship, you're a disgrace to the East India Company." And really burns his ears. And as they head across the Indian Ocean, the psychopath Geronimus gets in his ear and says, "When we get to Batavia, you'll be thrown in the dungeon, that'll be the end of you, you're finished. But downstairs, We have 12 chests filled with more money than we can ever know what to do with. Why don't we seize the ship? And so whispers on the waves at midnight. They start to hand out the cutlasses and the daggers, and 18 men are on board. And they believe they're still 600 miles out to sea, and the mutiny's about to start. When, in the middle of the night, the 4th of June, 1629, they're travelling at 8 knots, and everything's fine, and Jacobs is up on the ship, and he sees, what's that out there? Foamy, white water. And he yells up to the crow's nest, what's that? Because if white water, it's going to be a reef, they're in trouble. The crow's nest says, sir, it's nothing but the moonlight dancing on the waves. 2 minutes later, bang, they hit. And the ship comes up on the reef and crashes down on the reef, and carnage, murder, total chaos. And as the ship comes up, as the sun comes up, the back of the ship is broken, and they can see two tiny, tiny little islands on the other side of the reef. And they start ferrying the people, those that have not drowned, about 30 have drowned in the process. They get them onto the two little islands. Pelsart, the admiral of the fleet, then gets the longboat, and he puts 48 of the people in it, 47 with himself, and they go for help. They go to where Jakarta now lies, and they leave behind 230-odd people. And the last man off the ship as it breaks off is the man most afraid of swimming, which is Geronimus Cornelis. And finally the ship breaks up. He gets in a piece of driftwood and he washes up on the shores. Geronimus, Geronimus is here. And Geronimus says, I am the representative of the East India Company. I am in command. This is what we're going to do. We're going to build latrines here. We're going to put tents here. He imposes command. Meantime, he realises there's only enough food here for 40 of us for 6 months. But if 230 of us try to eat it all, we'll be dead in 2 weeks. So he gathers his mutineers to him. And he says, this is what we're going to do. This is how we're going to do it. We'll divide and conquer. I'll put 20 on this island, 12 on this island, 30 on this island. And they do that. So they divide them up. And then he sends out his thugs with their swords and their cutlasses. And in the night, they kill him. And they kill him. And they kill him. Some of them get away. And 50 of them get themselves on this island called the High Island, where they discover what they call jumping cats, which we know as wallabies, and they find water. So suddenly, on one island, you've got the goodies with no weaponry. On the other island, you've got the baddies. And the baddies, the 40 of them, have been killing everybody. They kill all the children. There's no use for the children. There's 25 women. We don't need 25 women to service our sexual needs. There's 40 mutineers by this pace. We'll have 5 women of common service that can service our sexual needs. The most beautiful Lucretia goes with Geronimus. And so you've got this Lord of the Flies situation on this one island. And Geronimus, and I'm almost there, Geronimus realises that if there's a rescue ship coming, they need to grab the rescue ship, but it'll be going, I'm just about 1 minute, it'll be going past the High Island. So he launches one attack, and they beat them back with slings and stones. And he launches the second attack, and they beat them back again. Beat them back on the third time, and at the height of the fourth attack, just when the goodies have lost 4 good men and the baddies are about to overwhelm them, at that moment, the most staggering, extraordinary thing, and it's all absolutely true, and Spielberg couldn't have done it better, at that moment, they look and they see the most amazing thing, and you'll find it on page 361 of my book. Thank you.
I think that might be... I started off with Eureka and we ended up with Batavia, but what a fine finish. I can't do better than that. And page 361. Right, okay. Well, that's at home. So look, just to Peter Fitzsimons, many thanks tonight. As I said, there's some copies of Eureka down the back. Batavia you have to buy at a bookshop. But for tonight, and a fine performance on a very important topic that Australians probably don't know as much about it as they should. Many thanks and well done.
Thank you.
Thank you, Peter.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.